Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit joriroese.com/retreats. That's joriereroese.com/retreats.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. This is Dr. John, and it is my distinct privilege to have with me today Michael Steger. And Michael is professor of psychology and the director for the Center of Meaning and Purpose at Colorado State University. He's an internationally recognized authority on the benefits of finding meaning in one's life and in one's work. Dr. Steger is a sought-after speaker, enjoys providing keynotes, workshops, and retreats around the world on topics ranging from meaning and purpose, flourishing at work, positive education, effective leadership, and expanding clinical practice by incorporating meaning and purpose assessment and interventions. He is the developer of the most widely used measures of meaning and purpose in the world, including the Meaning in Life questionnaire and the Work in Meaning inventory. He has been published in over 130 peer-reviewed journal articles and book chapters. That's quite a lot. Dr. Steger offers a number of online courses on elevating success in work and life, including his newest course, Meaning in the Moment, taught through the Whole Being Institute. Michael, welcome aboard. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Dr. John. I appreciate being here.
So tell me what you look like at your very best, kind of starting with that struggle and ending with overcoming it.
Yeah. So I think that coming to grips with who I am and what I'm good at and what I'm sort of terrible at is a lifelong process. But that whole reckoning with oneself seems, I think, is actually where I'm at my best. Like just being brutally honest with myself, my flaws, and where I'm not, in another sense, not making the most of the gifts and blessings I have in my life. So I think it's really, you know, messing up, thinking I can do something that I can't, getting out there, making mistakes in front of people usually, which is more exciting in some sense. And then, processing that. Well, you know, I have high openness to experience and low conscientiousness in my personality. Okay. So I'm often just like, well, this will probably work. And then that's not true often. But then the process that emerges after that, I think, you know, because I have a lot of curiosity. I think I'm reasonably creative. I'm pretty comfortable, I think, now being vulnerable. So having that chance to, you know, to just try something on the fly, make a joke, you know, backtrack from the joke. They're always digestive. There's nothing like particularly like blue about my comedy, but I do get fascinated by the digestive system. So, you know, like that, I think that process is me where, you know, I don't have a lot of filters. I don't have, a lot of guard up. So when I'm there, people are getting, they're getting me. They're not getting a polished, you know, from the can speech. And I think I've tried really hard to have a good heart. So I'm not out there to try and hurt anybody, make them feel uncomfortable or stupid. So I think that works because I don't want to feel uncomfortable or stupid either. So we all just like feel like, oh, things happen.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And so how did you get into studying meaning?
I think in some sense, it goes back to that me at my best. It just seems like a natural thing for me to want to be curious about. You know, I grew up in an area that, man, it just seemed like everyone was playing from the same script, you know, like growing up in the 70s and 80s and in a rural area of the country. everyone just seemed to be on board with stuff. Even when there were big problems going on, you know, like local farms were collapsing, you know, Ford Ranger plant and St. Paul was shutting down, like all these sorts of things were happening. People were still kind of weirdly on the same script about what we're supposed to do and what people are like. And that just rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I just thought that this can't be, we can't be this smart that we figured out everything in the universe and everyone around me is right. You know,
so what's the same script that you refer to?
The same script is, so these are the keys to success, right? So you get your hair right. You get a giant Esprit sweater. This is hopefully bringing some folks back. You have your collar up. You grow a mullet if you're where I'm from. And, you know, if you can afford a Mustang at some point.
That was not success where I came from. The mullet in particular.
well, that's exactly my point then, right? Because, you know, how could all these people think they're doing the exact right thing all the time and they're doing things that are not the same as what other people are doing? Like, what are the odds that this backwater place in rural Minnesota found the answers to life and didn't ever have to question it? We just all had to conform to this thing. I said, well, that's just weird, right? So I had my mullet. I had my pastel sweater. I did not have a Ford Mustang. I had a really old farmer car. And I just thought this is, I didn't fit in particularly well. So then I'm either going to decide that I'm an idiot or everyone else is. And at that time in my life, I was much more comfortable deciding everyone else was an idiot instead of me. And so I was like, well, I bet there's other answers out there. And I was a nerdy kid. So I was reading a lot. I was reading a lot of sci-fi, a lot about, you know, like these entry-level religion books, like Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse.
Yeah, great classic.
Yeah. For whatever reason, I got really big into Dostoevsky in like sophomore year and was getting to that stuff.
Well, I mean, a nerd.
Yeah. No,
you
I embraced
that
it.
In high school?
I not only was reading that in high school, I'm never going to get another job in my life, but this is where it came from. Like, I actually had to practice my violin like every day for something like 6 weeks in order to earn Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. Right.
Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. Yeah. That system broke down once I became more successful as a runner and a swimmer, but and I had
That's
some
harsh.
Other outlet.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my world. And I tried to engage people in conversations with it, which no one likes. Like, no one wants to be like,
who wants to talk about Dostoevsky?
Seriously.
Even Crime now, and Punishment.
I know. They're just lucky I wasn't into my Camus phase. Like, I've been reading the play.
Oh, yeah.
Been reading Star the plague. Trek. Yeah, I've been reading The Plague. Well,
Waiting for Godot, that's one of my favorites too, by Beckett.
Yeah, yeah, all these existential classics. And there was just this idea that, like, so in let's just use Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. In a sense, this is an exploration of moral relativism, right? So if we decide that there isn't a script to follow, then what? Like, how far would you push that? Would you kill an old woman? Would you think you can get away with it? Would there still be guilt? Is there something in us that drives us towards something that's good and reasonable? Or are we really just like unfettered, savage piranhas, you know? And
the Hobbesian view of human nature.
Yeah. So I was really fascinated by that. And I thought, you know, there's got to be a medium between everyone conforming to the mullets and Mustangs view of success and everyone being just in it for themselves. So what is that? What would that look like? And where would you look for that? You know, so I was an altar boy, Catholic, trying to understand all this sort of stuff. And also, you know, just very skeptical of almost everything that was handed to me as like, well, everyone knows this is true. I would automatically be like, this does not sound true then, you know?
So well, it's funny because I thank you for sharing that because it's, you know, you kept mentioning this same script. And for me, the same script is, you know, you go to school, you get good grades, you get in the best college that you can. You get good grades there, you get the best job that you can, you get married, you have kids, you make money, you make more money, you get promoted, and then you retire at 65, and then you're happy. That's kind of the script I saw.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is complete and utter bullshit.
Yeah, right.
It just doesn't work.
I think that script was insane too. I never jumped on that one. It's easy to look back in retrospect and say that, you know, the good person in those scripts is fulfilling part of a bargain that like the other side was no longer intending to fulfill, right? You work a job for 35 years, you get your watch, you get your pension, you retire. Yeah, fat chance, right? If you going into the workforce in the late 80s, early 90s, that's just not a thing. So it's easy to look back and say, well, yeah, I was just picking up on these massive, you know, socioeconomic trends, but I think I was just aggravated by annoying people. And they were aggravated by me because I was annoying too. So it was just like, well, you're dumb. I'm going to find a different way. And just because I was really after, in a sense, like, what is this really all about? Right. Not what is high school all about? Not what is, you know, the corn processing plant or the plate glass factory in my town all about?
What is the mullet all about?
it's all business up in front and then a party in the back. So that's all about. Yeah. So I had one of those. And then, you know, as an act of ultimate rebellion, revealing the fact that I was, again, this is killing my career, but I was a Rush fan in high school. So I turned
How does that kill your career? Rush is awesome.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, they
not
were.
Always the
I mean,
coolest, and, but you
and,
know.
No, not always the coolest. And here's
it was kind of a geek band, but amazing. 2112, great album.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, you don't want to be at like the happy hours I have with my brother where we like debate all of the Rush albums prior to 1986. But, you know, it's like that sort of thing. So I turned my mullet into a rat tail in honor of Neil Peart. And, you know, and the next hair style I had was like full on, like as long as I could get my hair, which it gets curly.
Well, now so I'm jealous because you could grow hair.
Well, when I was 20, I mean, who knows what could happen.
And
next.
Even when I was 20, I couldn't.
Well, I mean, maybe one of those, like, you could have maybe done something with some braids, maybe, John. I think, you know, that could have been
I don't know.
West Coast, no?
West Coast, yes. German family, yes. You know, it was genetic, I think.
Yeah. But I think, you know, so if I'm really going to try to connect all the dots, it's essentially this idea that it's a super ancient idea. Like, you have to know yourself and... the only path to wisdom is realizing you don't really know anything.
Yeah.
So
beginner's mind.
Yeah. It's just like a quest, right? You just have your eyes open and try to process with fidelity what you're experiencing and seeing. And then try to develop that moral compass so that when you have a choice about rejecting or accepting some kind of truth, you accept the ones that will make you better for your own sake and for others' sake. And you reject the ones that make you worse.
Yeah, it's funny to me because I remember, you know, I majored in philosophy in undergrad and I thought for many years that was a complete waste of time other than I enjoyed it. And then, you know, it's funny how it comes full circle 20 years later to positive psychology with, I think it was Aristotle's question of what is the good life and eudaimonia.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I think there's this intersection of, you know, morals, virtues, ethics, and meaning that really does lead to a good life.
Yeah, and it's particularly important, I think, at this time in our history because, you know, so your podcast is The Evolved Caveman, and, you know, if you think about what the meaningful life would have been 100,000 years ago or, you know, even a million years ago when our sort of like tiniest little hominid ancestors were apparently scraping patterns into rocks, right? Like just crazy stuff was going on forever. And what is the impulse that makes someone... a million years ago, create a crosshatch on a stone pulping tool or scraping tool? What is the impulse 100,000 years ago that is going to have people carving holes into the leg bone of a, I don't even know what their height, old bison, I guess, giant bison. Yeah. And, you know, what is the impulse that we had 1,000 years ago to create Gothic cathedrals and Romanesque cathedrals and all these sorts of things? And now what's our impulse to make a life that seems like it has that extra step beyond just surviving? And when we're at a time now when so much is changing, so much is falling by the wayside, I'd like to think about the idea that, you know, we've honed whatever social abilities that we have to become extremely effective at just destroying and plowing under like ancient, millennia old paths to meaning or supports for meaning. And we're coming up with not that much to replace it. So we look to philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let's move forward a little bit in history and let's talk about how the work of like Viktor Frankl and Erv Yalom enter into your work.
Yeah. So these are two giants in existential thinking. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple others. You've mentioned Sartre, I mentioned Camus. And, you know, in a sense, 100 years ago, folks were looking at a world that seems really eerily similar to what we're facing now, right? A global pandemic, raging out of control in some parts of the world, you know, violence and armed conflict.
Economic depression.
Economic depression and just like audacious economic inequalities, right? And the gaps between the middle and the top. And, you know, at that time, in the aftermath of World War One, folks couldn't really come to grips with what they'd just seen, right? Like the trench warfare, the people dying, suffocating in the mud in Belgium, the endless destruction, the widespread use of, you know, gas and mustard gas, poisons, indiscriminate killings over, no one could really articulate exactly what was at stake in that war too. So you had this experience of, seeing so clearly that the established systems were not providing the type of outcomes you would anticipate they ought to have. And that sort of birthed these folks like Camus and Sartre who are like, well, what the hell, right? Like what, like if we can't rely on government, we can't rely on religious institutions, we can't rely on mayors and social groups and armies and politicians to figure out what's going on, we're really on our own. And this is sort of an alarming idea, right? So anytime you choose to believe that one particular way of doing things is correct, let's take religions, right? You choose that your religion has the view of truth, and if it doesn't match another religion's, then they're wrong. To recognize someone else could be wrong in this question is to also recognize that you yourself might be wrong in this question. So where do you start in trying to create this idea of enough certainty to keep getting up in the morning? Or as Camus said, the biggest problem facing philosophy is, why don't we just all kill ourselves? Like, what keeps us going?
One of the classic questions.
Yeah, if there's no, like, it's a really good question, actually, as a practical question, in a sense.
Well, the flip side of it too is good too. Why should we live? For what should we live?
So that's, you already answered part of the question, right? So we assume that we should live for something. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that that's in us, that desire is in us, is essentially where Frankl started with his view of the human being, right? So he was part of the sort of second wave of Freud's circle, arguing with Adler over what the central motivations of a human are. Is it pleasure, as Freud says, or is it power, social power, as Adler says? And he said, no, the central motivating force within a human is meaning, a will to meaning, a will to have that. What am I living for? Right? And he was super inspired by Nietzsche's work. You know, that which does not kill me makes me stronger, mm-hmm. was big in his mind and Frankl's mind. But also, if you have a why, you can get through any how. This idea that if you have a what for, you can get up that morning, you can get through your day. And so that was his perspective, which was beginning to be articulated as a psychological idea instead of a philosophical or a theological mm-hmm. idea, which ended up being really, really powerful because his interest eventually was in helping people discover or uncover, in his view, what that purpose for them was. And then, of course, World War II came along and the Nazis came to power and they began to launch anti-Semitic campaigns. And of course, that accelerated into the Holocaust, where, you know, millions of folks were killed. And in particular, Jews and particularly Jewish intellectuals like Viktor Frankl himself. So the Holocaust occurs. He travels between four different concentration camps. He never sees his family members again the rest of his life. And he goes into that experience with the idea that if I have a why for this, I can get through any how. So this is like, if you have a tattoo on your body, you know, pain is weakness leaving the body or something like that, like take it to the maximum. That's what essentially Frankl had to do. And he came through that experience with this incredible book that everyone ought to read. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. You could at least read the first half, which is his autobiographical observations of life in the concentration camps and what separated those who couldn't make it from those who somehow pulled through. In his mind and in his observations, it was the people who had something on the other side of this experience that was worth getting through this experience. So it really was that idea from Nietzsche. And then he became this incredibly inspirational figure. You know, his book is still, I think it's like in the top 50 on Amazon today. It was originally scribbled as a manuscript in the 30s, right? So just super inspiring. And he did endless lectures, some of which are on YouTube, and they're just fascinating to watch. And this idea that, yeah, we're really creatures of meaning. that is what makes us different from, you know, even other noble apes or other animals or people in their worst cases. We are struggling for the sense that our life will be about something, that our life will matter, that our life will be, you know, glorious in some abstract way. And so that was this essential idea. And if you can tap into that, a lot of other things fade into perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so pretend I'm an obtuse 15-year-old with a mullet, and I am trying to make sense of life. How would you help me to understand what meaning is and why it's important?
Well, first I'd say, hello, stylish young man. I think you've got a successful life ahead of you.
Was that a successful life? There's a little bit.
I'm not touching down that. I mean, I assume this is,
The mullet was the hairdo of choice to get women back in the day.
Well, it works better if you have a Mustang than if you have an ancient Oldsmobile, but it's a wise choice even in today's world. But so I did do this. This was my job. So my first job, I kind of had a roundabout path to where I'm at now. I've never really had a career plan. I've just kind of gone with what seemed like it was the right choice in life. And that led me at one point to being a drug and alcohol counselor in a high school, doing family therapy and drug and alcohol screening. And I really wanted to say that exact. I really wanted to talk about meaning in life. I didn't want to talk about gossip and, you know, who's trashing. The phrase back then was like talking schmack. Like, I can't even tell you how many times it was just talking schmack was going on. So that was driving me nuts. And I would try to engage folks in conversations about meaning. And I think it is a much different landscape now than it was in the mid-90s, and even the late 90s, in terms of that question with teenagers, because I can have those conversations with my kids and their friends now that I couldn't have. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm just better at that. But I think that they're attuned to this idea that we have to confront on some level whether life has a purpose. Mm-hmm. And what is worth sacrificing to that.
Well, and I've heard that with millennials, that they want meaningful work on the whole. So
yeah,
I think there is this turning towards meaning and a need for meaning because I think we do have to offset that anxiety of meaninglessness.
Yeah. So having these conversations with teens is really, I think right now it's a great time to do it. You can start earlier. So, I've gone and talked to schools that are trying to launch positive education programs, primarily in Australia, but in other places. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ideas in there is, where do you start and how do you have these conversations without talking about Heidegger and, you know, Wittgenstein and all these other weird, super grouchy looking.
Two of my favorites, yeah.
Well, yeah, they don't look like they're fun at parties. In one of the webinars I had, I explained one of the problems with meaning in life is grouchy philosopher syndrome. And I tried to find like a frisky looking picture of, you know, Albert Camus or Simone de Beauvoir. And
frisky.
Yeah. I mean, just like, let's see what you got. Let's see what you got there, Simone. And
like the lampshade on his head kind of a thing.
Or even like one corner of the mouth smiling. That would be frisky for these folks. So there is this sort of stench of seriousness and ostentatiousness and irrelevant adult time-wastingness about meaning if it's talked about in that fashion, like we've done so far, all my fault. So if we get really practical about it, though, like there's like three dimensions that researchers seem to be really fixated on and in agreement about. And maybe there's more, maybe we can parse them into little smaller boxes. But right now, you can get pretty far thinking about just three ideas. So the first idea is coherence, right? Does life make sense? Can I create like a mental map or a mental model or like a core belief system from cognitive therapy or a schema from cognitive psychology? Do I have something that helps the world feel predictable and somewhat consistent and controllable? So there's that idea. Like, life is meaningful if it makes sense. Then the second idea is purpose, right? Am I pursuing something worthy of this sort of experience of life that I have? Like, what's this overarching, centrally organizing set of long-term goal or goals that I'm willing to throw my effort at, whether I get there or not? And then the third idea is significance. Like, does life have value? Is my own life worthwhile? Do I matter? And if you start thinking about those as maybe being able to build on each other, then you look back at this, at these ideas of like Carl Rogers, positive regard, unconditional positive regard, and the idea of like parental love, that's really building a sense of significance, right? So like 15-year-old mullet guy hopefully has a, or mullet woman, it doesn't have to be a particular stereotype here, like 15-year-old, hope ideally feels like their lives matter. Like it matters that they're there and not that they're not there. That there's something worthwhile about this experience and that there's something of value in their own lives. So that's actually a core part of meaning. And how do you express that? You express that with helping people find a sense of belonging, helping people find a sense that they have capabilities within themselves. There's a lot of different ways. Like just bonding is really important. You can also look at that 15-year-old and folks younger and say, so help me understand what your life path has been like. Like, what's your story? Like, where, like, who's in your life? What's the world look like to you? Like this idea that what have you formed in terms of your mental model about life and where you fit in with that, and getting a positive version of that. So a lot of folks these days, so it's shocking. I'll be picking up, usually it's my daughter from school, and you know, like the teenage will just like stroll into the street in front of oncoming traffic, looking at their phones, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know, of course, like, because I'm a grouchy old man. I was a grouchy old man when I had a mullet. So I've been a grouchy old man for a long time. And I'm like, what are these people thinking? Like, what is wrong with them? And my daughter's like, yeah, kids from our generation, we don't really care if we live or we die. You know, it's just, you know, the world's going to end and it's going to be horrible. Like she constantly talks about the fact that if a zombie apocalypse comes, she's not going to waste her time trying to survive any longer. She'll just be like, bite me or who knows? Like this idea that that's actually a world model, isn't it? That's like a mental model of the world, that it's so bad out there. And folks like Gen X and the boomers have so badly bungled it that it's almost not worth going through the trouble of fixing anymore. Might as well just
bungled it. That's a nice phrase. I think, you know, it's funny because I've got some depressed 20 somethings that would be happy in the event of a nuclear war.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to take their own lives, but they'd be dead.
Yeah. From a moral perspective, they did what was asked of them and they never gave up, but they don't have to keep not giving up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard. Right. And then purpose, of course, for a 15-year-old or a 20-year-old in those cases is what do you essentially that old, if you think about Twisted Sister, I Want to Rock, the old video that I'm sure shocked a lot of us with mullets back in those days. What do you want to do with your life? Like, what are you living your life for? And like trying to find something that feels both personal enough and important enough that it's worth kind of dedicating some of what you do to, that's a challenge too for folks.
Well, it's interesting. It makes me think of one of the gifts that my parents gave me, which was this, they instilled this belief in me from a young age that you are to leave the world a better place than you found it.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on.
And it's broad enough to find your own meaning and purpose. And it also was narrow enough to keep me going during difficult times in high school, right? Like I knew that there was something bigger for me on the other side, but I had to get through this, you know, at the time, difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a balancing act, right? Because on one hand, to have a meaningful life, you're supposed to be very authentic and honest about what you see and experience. And at the same time, you're supposed to be able to say, well, yeah, that looks pretty bad. And I just really screwed that up. Or I can't believe I can't get control of my anger yet. And yet at the same time, you're supposed to say, and with all that, life is still both precious and worth investing in and worth going through hardship for the cause of, you know, it's what's surprising about all this. I know that it feels like I'm starting to load up a lot of chores on people in order to have a meaningful life. But what's really surprising is that most people think that their lives are meaningful around the world. Like that is the norm, despite everything that's going on, despite how tricky it can be to navigate this question. Once you open the box, once you open the box and like, hey, what does make my life meaningful? You're like, and that uncomfortable pause starts to freak you out a little bit. Like we're still pretty good at that. And actually, I'm going to say, John, that this is part of our evolution. That this is, as much as I think this is a personally a spiritual or a very personal or even like kind of like an inspiring journey, I think that meaning in some ways is is one of those things that we evolved accidentally to do, kind of like math or, you know, calculus, right? So we evolved cognitive capacity to understand a world. And important to that was understanding other people, right? We wanted to know what they thought, what they were going to do, if their eyebrows went down, if they went up, what's going to happen next. So we were able to predict the world based on little cues. And why wouldn't we go from trying to predict what the biggest and strongest caveman in our group was going to do to what that storm cloud's going to do, or to what the sun's going to do next year? And we start like extrapolating this idea that we can begin to not only just understand who's right in front of us, but we can understand everything that's around us. And so I think that it's ingrained in us to create these models of the world that have a place for us in it somewhere. So I think it is really just a natural thing to strive for. And we really just want to know how to use that is the key for everybody. And we want to know how to rebuild that is the key for people who are really suffering.
Yeah. And one of the things that crosses my mind, you know, you were talking about grouchy old men and the seriousness of some of these philosophers like Wittgenstein. Where is there a place for things like humor and laughter and meaning? This is just a question for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so this kind of goes to the idea of how I make sense of the world, right? So part of it is I need to understand myself. Part of it is I need to understand other people. I need to understand other people at different scales, right? From you and me talking, but I also have to have in the back of my mind that other people will be listening. So I can't reveal all the dark secrets you told me earlier and, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? So we understand the world and our place in it, how to interact, how to transact, how to move through that space. And part of it is for me to feel like life is going the right direction. I feel like I got to be me, right? I want to be free to be me, and I want you to be free to be you, as long as the you you're being and the me I'm being isn't a huge jerk. Then of course I want you to express that which is unique and wonderful about you, and whatever it is, like there's something about me that I've always just had to try to make things funny, or at least funny-ish, right? You know, like it's like anything
to take the shot at humor.
You got to take the shot.
Those shots aren't always going to fall, which is fascinating to me too.
Yeah. No, I know that. I know that with a lot of firsthand experience.
Yeah.
Especially with my kids. They swear. Oh,
teenagers will grill you.
They swear. Well, you know, these are like, I've got more than a decade of my kids telling me, I don't understand why people think you're funny, Dad. you know, but I think for me, that's where it's at, you know, because in a sense, I mean, you can get super philosophical about the philosophy of humor. Like, why are things funny? Which is interesting, right? Because it's usually about insight and it's about juxtaposition, which are all very, very existential therapeutic things, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like to get insight into where you're at, to juxtapose like absurdities, or you say you want to do this, but instead you do that and blah, 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 blah. Like, so humor is a naturally meaningful thing. And actually, if you think about it, humor might be the most meaning-filled thing that we do other than like abstract expressionist art or something or emotional music, because it does have nothing in it other than this concoction I have in my head that I sort of abstractly reason will land at a similarly shaped concoction in your head. And then we all just like make this weird gasping noise and it's like a big party. I mean, just think about that. Without meaning, it's literally impossible to do that. So I think that that's really great. And I think that the new approach to it is a new approach to meaning is a lot less like, you must understand that life is meaningless and it is your job to find meaning while you are alone in the universe and no one understands you and you will die. Right. There's a little bit less of that, I think, a lot more of I mean, that turns some people off. I don't know why, but it's an exciting proposition to me. But, you know, right. Like instead I like to start with the little stuff. I like to start with the meaning. Like I think humor is an amazing example of how meaning just pops out of nothing, right? Into existence. There was nothing there. And then there's something funny. So like this idea of like, how do I travel through life without the incredible burden of being the next Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King Jr. You know, how do I go through life and just have like a me-sized purpose and still be okay with that? I think that's built out of seeing how your dreams and aspirations for the life that you can live and the person you can become actually finds root in how you do things today and the next day and in this moment. And it can be very lighthearted. Like I expand on this idea of savoring, what can start with mindful eating. And then I spend an entire hour in one of my classes I teach just on this idea of how savoring can be an inherently meaning-filled and meaning-giving mm-hmm. act. If we just turn it inside out a little bit. So it doesn't have to be so serious.
It's fascinating to me because I think of humor as often the violation of social norms or the violation of expectations, which kind of speaks to or gets to the violation of those mental maps that we've created to make sense of the world. And in so doing, it causes us to question those mental maps. Is this accurate? Is this true for me? But yeah. I think that, I mean, to me, life is meaningless without humor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think so too. And let me just push a little bit because I think you're onto something really important. If events cause us to question our mental maps or our meaning systems, we typically will feel pretty annoyed by that or agitated or anxious or overwhelmed.
Defensive.
We push back. We're like, no way. That's not happening. That's not real. I read a conspiracy on the internet.
And then you don't take in the new information.
You don't take in the new information. But if you can get to the point where you actually do question the mental map you're using, if it's uncomfortable, okay. If it's not uncomfortable, okay. But you're going to build the skills that you need in order to create a version of that model, that meaning system that fits the life you are actually in, as well as the life that you want to be in. Mm-hmm. So you're building those skills. It's not just an accident, the way that you view life. It's the way that you have chosen to view life.
I need to breathe. That's very deep. Okay, so you didn't
imagine Yoda saying that.
15-year-old with a mullet, I imagine. So let me get to one of the questions that I really wanted to get to, because I imagine people out there, if they're listening and they don't have a purpose, or they lack meaning, or they want to find more purpose and meaning in their life, how would I go about doing that? How do I identify my purpose?
Yeah. So I would say that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's thousands of years of human perseveration. That yeah, sounds quite right now, but on this very question, like, what is life for? So you don't have to create it from nothing. So I would say that there's just a couple ideas. The first thing is shift away from mentally solving the problem of life and shift towards doing things in life. So shift away from thinking about life and move towards living life. If you're curious about what you're supposed to do, start with something good. This should be pretty straightforward, right? So
back to the values, ethics, morals.
Yeah, you want to practice being a good person living a good life. I mean, why did you practice something that's a pointless person living a dumb life? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. So what is good? Like, what is a good thing? What makes you a better person? What helps people? Like, just find something to do in those realms. And this isn't an idea unique to me. I think maybe I try to make it a little bit more straightforward. But, Frankl was like, essentially, you cannot pursue happiness. Happiness can only ensue, right? Like, meaning. And it comes out of doing things, good things for the right reasons, right? Like helping people or trying to expand your moral worth. And so if we decide we're just right now going to set aside the big task of figuring all of life and existence out once and for all.
Right? We're not going to do that right now.
You wouldn't like the answer, John. It is actually,
I'm sorry, I got to go.
It is actually grow a mullet. And you've told me that that's difficult for you. So I was going to shield you from the truth there, but So what you were really striving for is, I think, not to try to invent something that no one's ever thought of before, because ultimately that's going to be in the error band of what's true about life, mm-hmm. I think, but it's to find your own path through stuff that probably other folks have decided is true before. Honesty, fidelity, integrity, love, caring, generosity, authenticity, right? Giving of yourself, being able to think of others before you think of yourself at times, but yet still being responsible so that you're not a burden on other people. Like, these are not brand new ideas, but I have rarely met a person who didn't have a little bit more room to live out something on a given day or in a given moment towards that. And then I think, you know, we celebrate a lot of weird stuff in our culture, right? Like, we have slam dunk contests, but we don't have, which are great. I mean, although
Halloween.
I can't dunk anymore, so maybe I'll stop watching those altogether. But, you know, like, but we don't really have contests of people feeling good about good things that they did, right? We want to distrust someone if they feel good about helping another person. But if that's part of what's going to make your life be better and more meaningful, and you did something that's worthy and worthwhile, why would you immediately discount that? Like, take a little moment and say, like, okay, well, life felt purposeless, life felt pointless, life felt meaningless, but I did this thing. I don't know how you can tell someone, like, yeah, and make sure you're completely apathetic about the fact that you took that risk and did that at a time when you're struggling and vulnerable. I think that's
absurd. The argument in the academic literature over altruism comes to mind, and this always cracked me up. You know, is altruism actually altruistic? Because we get something from giving something to someone else or doing something for someone else. So they win, but we win too, because we get a positive emotional boost, to which my response is, I don't give a rat's ass. Do what's good for other people anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have to annihilate ourselves to be good people. I mean,
I think we're overthinking it sometimes, which is what we do in ivory towers.
Yeah. I mean, the intellectual question of how do we define altruism such that no one ever benefits from it other than
or
other
no one
people.
Ever does it. Let's extinguish altruism.
Yeah. I will say, though, and I know that you do a lot of work around emotions, John. So one of the counter hypotheses for, you probably know this, but for your listeners, one of the counter hypotheses to that idea of altruism is all about self-benefit is the fact that we seem to be universally wired to experience empathy. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, acting in a good way can relieve the sense of empathy, but empathy itself feels both good and bad. It's not, you know, like pain. It's not like guilt or shame. Empathy arises naturally to attune us to moments when someone could benefit from our intervention. And that is a inherently outward looking emotion, right? I mean, it tells us something about ourselves, and it gives us this, mm-hmm. this sort of like really, grand experience of what it means to be alive. But they would say that the motion of empathy is one of the ways of running around the necessity that you're supposed to feel proud, or you're supposed to gain social capital by helping other people. That we're just actually, if we're wired to do this, of course we're going to be wired to feel good about doing it afterwards, or else we would have stopped helping each other, and there'd be six people left in the world, maybe each one on each continent, right? So I think that I love the idea that emotions like empathy that are generated by and directed towards experiences outside of ourselves, that we can access those and that we can actually listen to those. And that's a way of getting out of this. Because I think it's not just a trap for ivory tower theoreticians. It's a trap for all of us getting caught up in the what's in it for me. It's maybe the worst thing about being a human is like evaluating mm-hmm. everything about through the lens of what's in it for me right now. It's just, well, you can see what happens when we run a world like that after a while. Yeah. So
I've got one other, I could talk to you forever. I've greatly enjoyed this, but we got about 10, 15 minutes left. One of the things that I really wanted to get into, and I imagine this is under the dimension of coherence, of kind of making sense of the world and making it predictable, but you talked about some of the rules of these frameworks as givens. And I think, you know, I think of them as core beliefs. You mentioned schemas, but why are these understandings of how things work important? And I mean, yeah, let's just go to the core beliefs and these givens for a little bit, because these fascinate me lately. I just see the difference between people thinking, and I think there's three levels. There's, you know, self, beliefs about people in general, and beliefs about the world. And to me, it's a fascinating difference if you run through a day in your life with a core belief of people are generally bad or mostly bad versus people are generally good or mostly good. And you can dice that up different ways, but it dramatically impacts every interaction you have with every person throughout the day. And if you multiply that by 365 days of the year over years, it's going to radically influence how you view the world and people.
It's self-fulfilling.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because we have touched on this idea that existential philosophers have said we can't really know what's true, right? Mm-hmm. We have our own little limited experience and maybe nothing's true. But I think that these core beliefs can become the story that we make come true for ourselves. So if I'll just give an example that I like to talk about sometimes. And, you know, in my immediately post mullet, giant hippie hair, but pre bald, like shaved head days, you know, I was struggling to connect with people romantically. I was a little bit of a disaster. I was drinking too much. I was pretty quick to get sarcastic and insulting towards people. I was kind of lashing out, right? And I felt like the world treated me wrong and it owed me somehow. And being a kid of the 80s and Princess Bride and Say Anything and all these 80s movies, even 16 Candles, where like love redeems everything in the end, like the love, romantic love will wash away all your sins. Mm-hmm. I realize in retrospect, my core belief was the world had been kicking me so hard and it owed me now. And the way it was going to pay me back was by a woman that I ended up being infatuated with, loving me back. So I'd make these like weird declarations of love in the midst of, you know, I don't know, third bottle of malt liquor, whatever it was at the time. And, you know, like I would be shocked when it didn't happen. I only did this 4 times, right? But
same person?
No, different people.
Oh, okay. But
multiple utterances of, I just love you to each of those four poor, poor, poor women. And, you know, so it's just, I realized that was the idea that I had to come to grips with a lot of things at the time, but the core belief that the world owed me and it was going to pay me back by giving me love that would show that I'm worthy of a different fate in some ways was super toxic to me. But if I could have continued to go on those routes, I would have sunk lower and lower. You know what I mean? I would have been around with, like, you're going to find people who can tolerate almost any awful behavior. Now, do you want to spend your life surrounded by those people? I don't. But that was the course. And if I kept acting on that core belief, like I can lash out as much as I want and eventually I'll get what I want from someone and someone will love me back and everything's going to be okay, I could have made that come true. Right. In some form, a horrible form for everyone involved. Right.
Yeah.
But I realized that what the real message was is that I wasn't worthy of the love I was seeking. I need to actually be a person these are great women that I was really into. They weren't, you know, and I just was way out of their league for all the reasons you could think of. And I just needed to be. I didn't need to take seriously the idea that I need to be a better person. So that became my core belief, like how to become a better person. And it just kind of came naturally. Like weirdly, 4 years after the first time I said, I love you to one of these women, through the ups and downs of like the weird friend zone where you're just like hyper intense and freaking everybody out for a little while, I'm married to that person now, like years and years and years later. And it was way after I was like, you know what? I'm done with this. This isn't for me. I just need to focus on like not being a jerk all the time. Like that core belief actually that's what came true. So I think that's what starts happening because you anticipate the world responding to you the way your core belief says it will. And you can trigger that a lot of times. And you can shy away from times when a different response might be inviting you to a better future. So these givens, that's an Irv Yalom phrase for all of this. It comes from like geometry, right? Like, you know, given that right angles, you know, do something. I can't remember geometry, right? You can solve all sorts of problems, right? So, you know, so given that, the way to have a life that I will enjoy and find fulfilling is to become a better person without expecting anything back, then I can solve all sorts of problems going forward. So for me, that's how it works. And understanding the core beliefs that have been shaping you through your life is not always easy. If you feel bummed about your life, then probably some of those core beliefs are going to be really hard to confront and going to take a while to practice your way out of.
Yeah.
But that's the way.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that, you know, life owes me, and it made me think one of the big core beliefs about the world and how it operates that I see in dealing with people that are angry is life should be fair. And we all seem to be born with that one. It's really odd to me that we expect life to be fair. And it's so much easier when you realize it isn't. Bad things happen to good people at times.
Yeah. Yeah. I also noticed the other caveat to that is life should be fair in this specific way I have in my mind.
Life right? should be fair right now for me.
Right. Yeah. So if you're talking to folks in the Bay Area, life is not fair for them in the most case, right? If you compare if that person had been born somewhere else in the world at a different time, you know, like it, you can always find someone who seems to get away with crap that you can't get away with. You can always find unjust harms that have been done to you. And then it's natural to want that not to be true. We want to get the things that we want in life, and we don't want to take the crap that we don't want in life. That's very normal. But to try to turn that into a universal rule that everyone else is supposed to follow too, and whatever specific way it happens to pop into our heads, that's not helpful. It's not true. It's not accurate. It's not enforceable.
Well, you know, I only do that on the freeway when I'm driving, when I'm enforcing traffic laws for other people in my mind.
You know, I'm going to admit that when I was in high school, not just for traffic, but for literally everything in the world, I was pretty sure I was perfectly positioned to be the best ever benevolent dictator of everything and everything in the world. I just knew how everything should work.
I didn't realize they hired me as traffic cop, but apparently I am.
It's a rough job. It's not paid very well. You run into a lot of frustration with your employees, but you're the right man for the job. I'm sure of it.
No, that is a job that I've tried to give up in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Because the pay sucks.
The pay sucks. You take it home with you. I mean, it affects the family life. It's not good.
It just isn't worth it.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you this in wrapping up. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
Well, I'd like to just put a thought in folks' head about something you can do right now that's pretty easy. And then how you can take it to a deeper level if you want to make meaning more tangible for you right now. This abstract cookie thing that grouchy philosophers and people with mullets like to talk about. So it's got a corny name. I haven't found a better one, but essentially you're going to go on a meaning safari, a quick meaning safari. You can do this even in lockdown, you know, in a quarantine. You've got a cell phone or something that takes a picture. Take the next week or so, but at least the next hour to take a few pictures. I would like to limit people to about 8 pictures. But like start right now, take 2 of things that you feel in whatever format make your life meaningful. It can be a picture of a picture. Like if you love Paris and you can't go to Paris tomorrow, which if you're American, you cannot go to Paris tomorrow. You know, take a picture of something that you brought back with you from Paris or something that inspired you to want to go to Paris in the first place, right? So just do that. And you're saying to your own brain and your body that you can see meaning in the world around you. And you're also like almost like creating talismans that you can use to remind yourself that your life exists in a meaningful world. And that's the easy level. Like just go around and like recognize the stuff in your life that can really inspire you personally and bolster you personally and direct your attention and your love and your big heart and your big brain out into the world outside of you as well. To take it to another level, sit down with somebody that you don't think will laugh at you too much and just tell that person like what that picture is and what makes it meaningful to you. Invite them to touch bases with you and do the same thing for you too. Easy, free, and makes meaning tangible and also endows some of the things you're already surrounded by with the meaning that's already in your life.
Well, that's a fantastic suggestion. And I have to say a heartfelt thank you because this conversation has been fantastic, enjoyable, and poignant. Thank you so much for joining me. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Dr. John. I really appreciate it. And thanks for your time.
All right. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.